Tudor Parfitt, Dr. Tudor Parfitt, coming up in just a second. We'll get an update on the Ark of the Covenant. Quick answer to a question posed in the first hour. I had to go to coasttocoastam.com. Always great stories. Find out more, too, about like Paranormal Date and Coast to Coast Insider and all of that. But I drew your attention to a story in the news down on the bottom of the fold. Just before you'd go to the jump page for more, it's a story about the guy who created the free libraries, and many of you saw this very weird, cool thing that happened in his obituary. Todd Bold, the guy that created the free library system, these wonderful handmade boxes which people would purchase from him that would go in front of their homes that people would put books in. So that kids coming by could pick out something new to read, or people who are going by looking for a new novel or some mystery or something could stop, pick something out they like, walk on, read it, either drop it off at another library somewhere else, bring another book back to replace it, or, you know, keep it forever and ever as a keepsake. So it was wonderful what he created, and it went international. And there's a photo there of him displaying the free library boxes. And I didn't know it until a Coastie saw this obituary and sent it to me a couple of months ago. And I just thought I'd post it for kind of a year in the review thing, is that we lost Todd Bold this year. And it was a sad thing. And he was just such a great guy. He died too early. But right there, the books that he is displaying are mine. I really was not expecting that at all. So Dizzy the Mutt with the Propeller Butt was the first child's book I had written, and he's holding it up to the camera, which was just totally weird. And even inside the box is my follow-up to that, which is Jackula the Vampire Dog, about my dog that still lives with me to this day. And so both of those were books that I wrote for charity. We sold to support dog charities in Minnesota. And there you go. So many of you saw it. Thank you, everybody who played along with that game. And it just goes to show you, if you, like the previous caller last hour, ever get around to writing a book, it may not be a bestseller. It may not make it to the top of the New York Times, you know, bestseller list. But you'll never know whose hands it ends up in. And that's not a bad thing either. So thank you, Todd, for doing that. And sorry to the family for the guy we lost. But his legacy will live on in those little free libraries all over the world. Tudor Parfitt coming up next. And we will explain where the Ark of the Covenant is or isn't, as the story at FoxNews.com revealed or discussed last week on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Dr. Tudor Parfitt, it was wonderful to see you mentioned again recently in an article on FoxNews.com, and thank you again for agreeing to come on the show. Good to hear your voice again.
Well, you haven't heard it yet, but here it is.
Well, I have now, so my prediction came true. And I will say, I think of all of the things that were in the article about the Ark of the Covenant, an update I'm really looking forward to discussing. I think the thing that surprised me most was that you are also now in the faculty of Florida International University. When did this happen?
Yes, I came, or I went stateside in 2011, and I've been very, very happily ensconced in Miami ever since. It's a great university, Florida International University. I'm very proud to be there.
Well, we're proud to have you here stateside. I know you taught in Canada for a while, didn't you, early on in your career?
Yeah, I started off in Canada at the University of Toronto. That was years ago, but most of my career has been between Oxford and the University of London, and particularly the School of Oriental and African Studies, where Professor Ullendorf is going to come into our story today, where he was a professor for many years as well.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Are you enjoying the weather of Miami versus the weather of London?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very nice. Never have to think about heating or sweaters, anything like that. No, it's very good. And I get to spend, the kind of best months there, which is to say, you know, the autumn and the spring and then I usually get back to the UK for the summer months. So it works out pretty well.
I think one of the times we had you on 7 or 8 years ago on Coast to Coast, I asked you about your son, and you said that one of the benefits of all of this talk about you being an incarnation of Indiana Jones was that your son thought it was very cool that you were connected to the Ark story. But he was young at the time. Where is he now?
Yeah, well, I think he still thinks it's reasonably cool, and he's actually by now, I mean, time passes. He's finished his degree in the UK, and he too's actually just moved to Florida, and
Oh,
he's going to
wonderful.
be studying at Florida International University as from next week. Yeah.
Following your footsteps into the antiquities?
Not really. No, he's decided that he wants to, he wants to get into business, and he's going to be studying Spanish and business studies at FIU. So a different trajectory, but I guess he's interested in what I do. He's read quite a few of my books and so on. So
That's a
yeah.
challenge. That's a challenge in itself because you've written so many of them. And so that brings us back to your work on the Ark of the Covenant was a game changer and it was controversial. I wonder if it still is. And it you were you proposed some things, you articulated, you disseminated things from the Bible record, which some people disputed. I don't know why. I thought you made your case beautifully on where the Ark ended up, and it was the result was books and TV specials about the Ark of the Covenant. This particular article, though, sort of picks up the story in a different way and tells the story of a former colleague of yours, Dr. Uhlendorf.
Yes, he was a very senior colleague of mine. He was kind of, the probably the most eminent scholar of Semitic studies, which is to say, Semitic languages like Arabic and some Ethiopian languages, Hebrew,
Aramaic,
Aramaic. These are all Semitic languages, and he knew them all. And he was born in Germany, and then was able to get to Palestine, I think before the war. And he's Jewish, of course, so he escaped Germany at a very good time, and then he went on to be a really, really great scholar of all things Ethiopian. And he was a friend of the emperor, King Emperor Haile Selassie. And he had very, very intimate relationship with Ethiopia over decades. And specifically, he was he went there shortly after the British troops freed Ethiopia from the colonial force of fascist Italy. Which is probably a story that not many of your listeners know about, but Ethiopia had been invaded by the Italians, and it was a pretty harsh regime, it must be said. And then they were kicked out by the British as part of the events of the Second World War, and Uhlendorf was sent to Ethiopia. And as part of the British occupying force.
And it was there then, as a returning scholar with the new, with the expansion of the British force and the expulsion of the Italians, that he encountered these sort of compelling new arguments about whether or not the Ark of the Covenant was being held in a, it was a church, wasn't it, that he first learned about?
Yes, I'm sure that he knew the legend. I mean, the basic legend, which all Ethiopians know about. You go and speak to any Ethiopian in any of the many places in the United States where Ethiopians are,
Right.
and ask them where the Ark of the Covenant is, and they'll come up with the same story, which is that it was taken from the land of Israel nearly 3,000 years ago, and indeed it was stolen from King Solomon by a young man who was the son of the Queen of Sheba, following an affair she had with King Solomon. And so what happened was the Queen of Sheba famously went to Jerusalem to study with King Solomon. And when he returned to Ethiopia from Jerusalem, he took with him the Ark of the Covenant, as well as a number of companions who were the Jewish aristocracy of Israel at the time. And this young man was Menelik, and he became the first emperor of Ethiopia, according to Ethiopian legend. And this very beautiful story of how he acquired the Ark of the Covenant is the kind of founding myth of Ethiopia. It's hugely, hugely important to all Ethiopians. This is the tale that that starts their history as a nation. And of course, you have to have it has to be have some topographical point of relevance to the story, and that is a particular church in Aksum, the old imperial capital. And so that's it. Ollendorff, when he went with British troops into Ethiopia, knew perfectly well that this Ark of the Covenant was in a particular church, and he went along and was kind of interested to see what was in the church.
So, by the way, back to your point about even Ethiopians in America know this story. I had a cab driver. I think the last time I was in, I was in Washington, D.C., and he was Ethiopian. And I asked him about that. I just said, hey, where's the Ark of the Covenant? He goes, it is in Ethiopia. I said, that is part of your national understanding, isn't it? As you all are the protectors of the Ark. And he he went in from the rest of the drive all the way to the airport. He went into great detail about how Ethiopians are raised with that understanding. So the idea was that it was a particular church almost, I don't want to overstate this, but I can't remember whether I specifically saw this in one of your specials, but I think there was a particular church that kept it under kind of high security. It wasn't just something that they had, lying at the altar, but this was a relic that was so important that the church was kind of built around the protection of the Ark.
That's right. it wasn't kind of military protection.
Right.
But the story is that in this particular church in Aksum, there were two priests whose responsibility it was to guard it throughout their lives. And when one was sleeping, the other one would be on duty.
Right.
He was allowed
That's right.
to the church to see it, except obviously for for priests higher up in the hierarchy who were unable to go in if they wished. But that didn't happen very often, and there was a huge amount of secrecy that surrounded the object that was in the church. Naturally, for a young scholar of Ethiopian languages and history, having the opportunity of being able to take the story a little bit further was very enticing. As you can see, young Ollendorff there, I believe he was wearing a British Army uniform at the time, which gave him a certain amount of prestige and power immediate circumstances of the of the liberation of Ethiopia. He must have been tempted to push things a little further than probably he normally would in terms of trying to find out what was in there.
Let me back up a little bit. What kind of a church was it? Was it a Roman Catholic church? Was it an Orthodox church? I can't remember.
Yes, it's all of the kind of historical churches in Ethiopia belong to the, if you like, the Coptic
Okay.
Church. It's the
Right.
indigenous church of Ethiopia and
And
it's one of
Egypt.
the yes, and Egypt as well. That's correct. And it's one of the most ancient churches in the world. It's got, it's got liturgy and biblical translations going way, way back to the beginning of the Christian period. And it's, of course, it's a large, quite densely populated country. And it's one of the very few countries in sub-Saharan Africa which has got a written tradition going back nearly 2,000 years, perhaps even more than 2,000 years. And so compared, let's say, with Nigeria or Zimbabwe or any of the other African countries which don't have these written traditions, it kind of stands alone as a Christian black African state with a very rich tradition of written history and literature and so on.
You know, I can't, if it might, I haven't checked lately, but it seems to me the Coptic Christian Church of that part of Africa has always had sort of an uneasy communion with Rome, or, at the time, Constantinople, where there was a, they, because they kind of did things on their own. They considered themselves such an early church in the in Christendom that they did not feel beholden to other international seats of the Christian tradition, which I always thought was really cool about the Copts, that they kind of made their own rules a little bit, whether anybody liked it or not.
Yes, I mean the thing to remember is the fact that not that long ago there was no connection at all between the Coptic Church of either Egypt or Ethiopia and the rest of Christendom, for the very good reason that Muslims controlled quite a bit of West Africa, all of North Africa, and a good chunk of the Middle East during the period of the Ottoman Empire. And so it was impossible to cross this this line of military Islamic might, which stretched from the Balkans right round the eastern and then the southern parts of the Mediterranean. And of course, much further east, so there was no kind of way around it. And until the discovery of the Southern Passage around the southern tip of Africa in at the beginning of the 16th century, there was no way of connecting Europe with let's say with India or with China
Right.
without going through Islamic territory. And so it meant that Ethiopia was in the unique position of having an ancient Christian civilization which was simply not in touch with all of the other great centers of the Christian faith and culture. And that really is the most signal fact of Ethiopian history, really, is the fact that they were isolated. And when eventually
Whoa, whoa, whoa. We'll
after
have to pick
40.
up that thought here in just a second, because we're coming up on the break. And it isn't, as you point out, that isolated piece of Christendom is essential to understanding the Ark of the Covenant there and where it is or is not now. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We have Tudor Parfit on. Dr. Tudor Parfit is now teaching here in the United States in Miami at Florida International University after being an internationally recognized expert on Jewish studies, Jewish antiquities, and in particular the Ark of the Covenant. And we're just getting to that part of this new story that cleared the wires last week concerning Dr. Fred Uhlendorf, a former senior colleague to Tudor Parfit. He was quoted in the story on FoxNews.com about really where and what the Ark of the Covenant is. And for some people, it remains kind of a controversy. We'll get to it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're just talking with Tudor Parfit, one of my favorite names of all time, by the way. It really is. It always has been. That and Amos Funkenstein, the famous Jewish theologian, which I just, that there really was a guy named Amos Funkenstein is still the greatest thing ever. So we were just talking about the fact that the Coptic Church, the Coptic Christian Church, was kind of an island unto itself for many years, sort of remaining out of communion with other aspects of Christendom. And the same could be said about Ethiopian Judaism, right, which is something that you helped to bring to international attention, was that in the diaspora of Jews around the world, that there was a concentrated, if perhaps slightly lost, tribe of Israel in Ethiopia.
Yeah, that's right. When the Portuguese finally rounded the Cape of Good Hope and discovered that you could actually get around Africa, because nobody knew that you could do that prior to Vasco da Gama, and they came up then the east coast of Africa in their galleons, and they sent a landing party ashore, and which made its way into Ethiopia. And they were astonished when they discovered that there's a whole Christian society there that obviously was very, very closely connected with different forms of Christianity in different parts of the world. So, and they too, early on, we're talking 16th century, noted that there was a Jewish community there, which is referred to by the name Falasha. And they in fact, were not a hugely ancient community, but they developed into a kind of a Jewish community within Ethiopia. And of course, the story of how they got to Israel in the 1980s and 1990s is a major story of Israeli derring do and so on through the operations, Operation Moses, and then Operation Sheba and Solomon, which brought the entire community pretty much from Ethiopia to Israel.
And you played a part in that.
Well, yes, sort of. I'd been asked in 1984 to go to the Sudan because rumors had reached London that the Jewish community were being poisoned in the refugee camps by other Christian refugees, which sounded like a weird, bizarre story. And so I was asked to write a report for something called the Minority Rights Group, a London-based NGO. And so off I went, and it just so happened that I bumped into the secret Israeli operation, which was being done in conjunction with the Sudanese secret police. And so there was I kind of wandering around, not knowing that this was going on. And anyway, I met the one of the guys running the Israeli operation, trying to save these Jews from the from these camps, and he was working for Mossad, and we had an agreement that if I kept my mouth shut and didn't reveal the story that I'd uncovered to the press, when the time came and when the people were out, he would then tell me the full story. And that's more or less what happened. A few weeks later, some Israeli publication in Israel revealed the story rather inadvertently, but the story was revealed. It became a front page story on every newspaper in the world. And the following day, this man telephoned me from Tel Aviv and said, "Well, you've kept your side of the bargain, now I'll keep my side of the bargain." And he flew over to London and told me the bits and bobs that I hadn't been able to piece together. And then the great Lord Weidenfeld, who was one of the great English publishers at the time, called me and asked me to write a book, which was called Operation Moses. So that was my involvement. I saw the people as they were coming in from Ethiopia, and they were starving, and they'd been attacked by bandits and by wild animals, and they were in the most dreadful, dreadful state. Some of them had been on the road for, you know, up to 3 months. It was quite an incredible exodus from Ethiopia, and they had no idea really where they were going or what they were doing. In many cases, they were from extremely simple villages with very, very little connection to, you know, to the modern world. And of course, this was the time of, you know, you remember Bob Geldof and the you know, the stories of the Great Famine of Ethiopia, and,
sure,
and this was happening in the background to the exodus of the Ethiopian Jews. It was a very dramatic story, an incredible story.
Yeah, I think, as I understand it, your research and then your writing about it also helped to undergird the understanding in Judaism, the connection between these Ethiopians who look different than, you know, they weren't the European Jews that had helped really settle Israel. You know, this was a good way for them to try to understand how they were connected together. And I thought your work on that was considered seminal to the way in which the Ethiopian Jews were then embraced within Israel. So picking up the story of Dr. Ohlendorf, though, and what brought you back on Coast to Coast was this recollection that he had a chance to see the Ark of the Covenant then at this Coptic Christian church. And in seeing it, what do you believe he had actually seen? I mean, what did he think he had seen? And what do you think, after he was able to use his, you know, British Army muscle to get in through the door, what is it that you thought he actually saw?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be clear that he didn't exactly spend his life talking about it. Now, why is that? Why did he not talk about it very much? He could have made a lot of money as a result of this story, but he didn't. He gave one interview to some Californian newspaper quite a number of years before his death. But he never mentioned it in any of his many books. But he did mention it in casual conversation to me and other people. But he didn't want his views to be made public. And he didn't want his impressions really to, you know, to get out there and to get back to, particularly to Ethiopia. And the reason is that what he saw, as he made clear in the one article and in the various conversations that I know about, was the thing that he saw wasn't old. It wasn't an ancient artifact. And it had nothing, therefore, to do with the original Ark of the Covenant. And we've got a pretty good idea from the biblical account, as many of your readers will know, listeners will know, of what the Ark of the Covenant actually looked like and what it did, what its function was. And at the same time, we know, anybody who knows anything about the Coptic Church in Ethiopia knows that every Ethiopian church has got on the altar, you know, in our altars in America or Europe, you might find, I didn't know, candles or something like this, candlesticks or some other feature. You might find a cross.
Right.
In Ethiopia, what you find on the altar is an ark. Now, what is an ark? An ark is simply a box, and the word ark in Hebrew, aron, simply means a box. And we know more or less what the size of the original one was, because it's spelled out in the Bible. And in the case of the Ethiopian box of the covenant, if you want to call it that, we know more or less what kind of size that is, because they're all the same. And it's just a way of imagining the Ark of the Covenant, which, as I said early on, forms part and parcel of the original story of the Ethiopian state, of the Ethiopian empire, and the Ethiopian royal family. So it's kind of commemorative of that original state-founding event, myth, of course. So what Edward Ollendorff discovered when he went into this church, and one can imagine the priests being indignant at this chap coming into their church without permission, and probably astonished that he could speak Amharic, and that he seemed to know what he was doing. And they would have probably cowered away from him and tried to shield the ark from his eyes. But according to his own testimony on these couple of occasions, what he saw was not some ancient relic as described in the Bible. It was rather a modern symbolic representation of the Ark of the Covenant, such as you find in every Ethiopian church throughout Ethiopia.
So we would call it either a replica or a forgery.
Yes, I mean, I think that if you were going to call it a forgery, you'd have to call every single ark in every church in Ethiopia forgery as well. I don't see it as being a forgery particularly, any more than, every brass cross that you find in every Catholic church throughout the world is a forgery based upon the imitation of the true cross. It's simply there. It's a kind of common or garden religious artifact. You could call it a replica, if you like, some kind of a replica of the original. But it's what you find in every church, and that's what he saw there. The question is, why didn't he reveal what he'd seen? And of course, I think the answer must be obvious, and it is that he didn't want to offend the emperor and the other Ethiopians that he knew and loved, and he kept that his story secret until his death, as I said, except for one newspaper article that he probably inadvertently, without thinking, revealed the story. And it didn't make the headlines at the time, and it's only really now that what he said years back is being given the attention that it actually deserves.
Okay, but so help me understand the confusion then. So if we were talking about this church inside of Aksum, Ethiopia, right, the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion, that the church that had two priests who would rotate to always be overseeing the Ark of the Covenant that was inside, if they knew it was just a replica, like any church would have, why did they guard it so? Why did they oversee it? Why did they value it so much if they knew it was just a replica?
Well, I don't know that they particularly did.
Okay.
I mean, I don't suppose the thing had been cobbled together, a few days before. It might have been old in terms of, compared, let's say, with the life of the priests. It may have been hundreds of years old.
Right.
What I mean is that it wasn't an object which was sufficiently ancient and sufficiently close to the descriptions that we have of the Ark of the Covenant as to lead him to think that it had any particular importance. It looked just like the other arcs. It could have been an older one than the majority, but it wasn't something that had been created 3,000 years earlier. That's what I mean.
Right.
And if the priests had spent their lives guarding an object which they implicitly believed to be, the original art, of course they would guard it with great diligence. And of course they weren't themselves historians or archaeologists or experts in ancient Near Eastern history or biblical history or anything of that sort. They were simple priests whose job it was to guard this object, and which is what they did.
What is the status, as we speak, of this replica of the Ark of the Covenant as described in the Bible, this Ark of the Covenant which any church in any Coptic tradition might actually display on or near its altar? What is the current status of that replica at that church in Ethiopia?
Well, I don't know that it's changed. Once in a while, you have news of it. I can remember a few years ago, a senior cleric in the Ethiopian church announced to a waiting world that he was going to make the big reveal the following day and show this ancient object for what it is. But nothing happened after that, although it filled the wires for a while. And of course, people, I don't know whether to use the word unscrupulous or optimistic writers, will fill lots of pages about this object as if it was something of great antiquity, and it's been connected with all kinds of conspiracy theories and other sort of, wonderful but unprovable kind of legends of the past. So it's still, I think, a powerful item. So if you ask about its status, it certainly has got the status, has got the possibility to intrigue people and to mystify people. So it's something which is worth having. Here, the story of Ullendorf is perhaps the only actual glimpse at what it really is, and we have to take his word for it as a great scholar that what he saw was a relatively modern artifact.
Yeah, and even by modern you mean like post Middle Ages modern, but yeah, that this is a replica.
He never put a date on it, but okay. That's what I would kind of imagine. You'd see something and think, oh, that's nice, it looks like all of the others. Nothing special. After all, if you've got a wooden object, whether it's covered in gold or whether it's not covered in gold, and it was 3,000 years old, you would know it's 3,000 years old. It's not. It wouldn't look the same as other arcs which had been made over, let's say, 50, 100, 150, couple of hundred years.
So we'll hold it there for the moment, and I'll return to the conversation with the question about the two arcs, the difference between the Ark of the Covenant and the Ark of War, and then get an update on your research into where the real Ark is. Do you still believe what it was that you were concluding back in 2010 and 11? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.